Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week our attention turns to a review of the state of the Australian property market, which after a strong rebound in values has come to a shuddering halt with the COVID-19 lockdown. Auction clearance rates and buyer sentiment have collapsed, unemployment is surging, and mortgage availability is tightening. In conjunction with this, immigration has fallen dramatically as travel movements have been restricted and foreign university students have been told to stay at home. And I'm sure there's plenty of empty bedrooms out there. Here to ask the question, how heavily has the Australian property market caught the virus? I'm joined by our chief economist, Leith Van Onselen. G'day, Leith.
Hey, Tim. Hello, everyone.
Our head of investments, Damien Klassen. Hello, Damien.
Tim.
And a friend of the show, of course, president of the tax reform think tank Prosper Australia and director of the respected real estate advocacy firm Cashmore & Co, Catherine Cashmore, welcome back to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Good to be back.
Lovely, lovely. And just a quick reminder before we begin, before we get started, to subscribe on YouTube and to click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And for those listening in live, head over to nucleuswealth.com/webinar and leave any questions in the chat box below the video. So let's get started. Our agenda for today, we're going to start, by running through the auction clearance rates and their recent collapse. We're going to look at, following on the collapse theme, we're going to be looking at sentiment. We're then going to be looking at some unemployment figures, also a view to the immigration as well. And then, of course, we'll be hearing from views from the front line from Catherine Cashmore, who's going to be talking through what she's seeing out there as well. Finally, of course, as always, we're going to roll through an investment outlook and how we reflect these themes every day here at Nucleus Wealth in the portfolios. So with no further ado, let's kick it off. Auction clearance rates, Leith, what are we looking at?
Looking at a collapse, Tim. It's a collapse across the board. No, just joking. Look, the pretty much all the data pertaining to the Australian property market has turned, you know, pretty dire since the coronavirus lockdown commenced mid March. Before that period, we're obviously experiencing a very, very strong rebound in property values and transaction volumes, and there was fear of missing out was running rampant. Everyone was itching to get into the market and it was going gangbusters. We had very high auction clearance rates running in the mid to high 70s to 80% across Sydney and Melbourne. And unfortunately, the lockdown has changed all that. So the final auction clearance rate, which is reported every week by CoreLogix, crashed to the lowest level on record to about 30% in both Sydney and Melbourne and nationally. And usually everyone in front of you who's watching this live can see that I've plotted clearance rates against prices. And generally clearance rates lead prices, and the collapse to 30% is suggesting a pretty hefty fall in property values. However, I will add that there's a lot of noise around the data at the moment because with the coronavirus lockdown, the basically live auctions were cancelled. So auctions are no longer being done the usual way, you know, whereby you rock up on a Saturday and there's a huge crowd and everyone bids for property. Instead, they've gone to online auctions. And that's obviously for social distancing reasons. And because of that, there's been a lot of auction withdrawals. So the auction clearance rate, although it's at about 30%, which is the lowest ever on record, and in normal times that would suggest an absolute massive property crash, unprecedented. They are lower then it's really an apple and pears comparison at the moment. So yes, the auction market is very weak, but that's as much to do with the change in the way auctions are conducted and the huge number of withdrawals. So
and is that also? I would have thought, and it's probably more of a question for Catherine, is that, you know, in ordinary times and certainly in boom times, you do an auction because you want to get the maximum possible price and you want people all there competing against each other and pushing it up. It feels as if at the moment you're sort of thinking, well, I'm not going to get the maximum possible price from that because you've got social distancing, it's all online. And so maybe some of the auctions are actually more of an indication of I've just got to sell the house this weekend. I'll take the best price I can get regardless, but I've got to sell it, you know, relatively quickly. Do you think that might be the case?
Yeah, a few things happened when this first came in because a lot of people panicked initially and bought forward options in anticipation of the lockdown. So auctions that were going to take place on the weekends were bought forward to midweek and done in-house. So there was definite panic among vendors wanting to get a price and wanting to get it out of the way. And I think a general feeling at that point, and it's interesting how the emotions have affected sentiment over this period, because at that point, everybody just wanted to hunker down. And there was also on the buyer side, a lot of panic to get into the market before the lockdown came on. So we were feeling it on both sides. It felt like we had to get everything completed before everything was going to be shut up, and then re-establish an atmosphere and see where things were going to go after then. Once the lockdown kind of came in, it didn't stop the auction market immediately, because there's a lot of existing buyers in the market. So recall, as we were coming up to this, most of the push in prices, most of the rebound was coming from home buyers, not from investors, and it was coming on the back of a shortage of stock. And so we came into this with that still happening and the existing home buyers that were in the market panicking to get in. So we didn't feel it so much on the ground initially. And there was already some, there's a company called Gavel who goes around recording auctions. They have a lot of online platforms, and there were some other companies that immediately approached agencies and said, okay, we can do auctions online. And then there's just been a panic as to how do we sell these properties via auction. So some are doing it on Google Hangouts. Some have been doing it over Facebook Live. What it has done, so that was, as we came into the pandemic, obviously there was still competition, and there's been enough competition to carry out an auction. But very quickly, transparency has disappeared from the market, and the auctions that we're discussing now are a good example of that. You no longer can eyeball a bidder. And what I've noticed with the ones that I've taken part in is that, you know, certainly the ones over Facebook, all the buyers are on a phone to separate agents. So you don't know what's going on, and you don't know what those discussions are. It becomes very difficult from a technical point of view when you're trying to deal with that. I mean, I don't think there are any dummy bidders around at the moment, but if there were, it would make that activity a little bit easier than it has been in the past. I think the other thing is so many auctions were withdrawn. So there's fewer and fewer properties that are being listed for auctions now. But there were a lot of properties that were withdrawn from auction, and then piling into the clearance rate from those that weren't withdrawn are a lot of post-auction negotiations, because the auctions tend to, some of them have wound up early, and then they go into a negotiation. And then unlike a public auction where there's a very well established set of rules, do you then count that auction that has sold via negotiation in the clearance rate or not? And they tend to be piled into the clearance rate. So we used to use auctions. It was a very clear indicator of the heat in the market. Buyers that went to an auction would get a very good indication emotionally whether they were going to miss out and needed to extend their budgets, and had that roller coaster of emotions going to and from an auction, missing out, I'll pay a bit more next time. And all of that's gone.
And is it fair to say, Catherine, that without this live, this live kind of, you know, cage fight that you often see at these auctions, that the old animal spirits is gone? Like, there isn't the urgency now to get in, because you don't get that adrenaline rush that you typically see at a normal face to face auction.
There's a little bit of. There's a little bit of panic on the side of the seller, but there's also, you don't know what the conversations are going on between the agents and the buyers. So, I mean, my job in terms of dealing with a buyer is obviously to talk them through what's happening with the auction and protect them, from my point of view, from agents that are going to come over and encourage you to spend more. But as I said, it's changed. Just as the news has changed every day and been sparking those emotions from anyone that's been caught up in this in a business sense, as to, are we going to go into a steeper lockdown? Is it getting worse? Are we getting better? and the language has changed. It's that things have been changing every day on the ground. And so what started off with the auction still having a little bit of competition around them, and we were still having to bid. The bottom hasn't dropped out the market yet. There's definitely been discounting. Now what we're seeing is that people are getting a lot more reluctant to pay, and there's pay the prices. There's a lot more negotiation going on. An auction isn't necessarily the best way to sell in this market. So it's been interesting to kind of see. But the panic that's come from buyers, and certainly the ones that I mean, over this last year, I've had more home buyers on the books than I've ever had before. Before that, there was a lot more investors that were, you know, and developers that was looking to get into the market with me. But there's just had been a rush of home buyers over the last 12 months. And with the home buyers that I still have had on the books, and I've still got a couple of them, it was really a panic of getting in before their pre-approvals ran out, because coming against that was a real genuine fear that the banks are not going to renew the pre-approvals, because they've put a blacklist of industries that they're not lending to. They've become very cautionary. And that can even be industries that we think we might assess are okay going forward. But even though interest rates are still low, it's become, there's a little bit of anxiety for people caught in a chain of, I need to find somewhere to live, or I've sold my property, to get into the market. And it's, yeah, and there's been a whole different heap of sentiment. So some buyers, I had one buyer drop out early on me who said, a first home buyer who said, no, we're entering the Great Depression. and that was actually for a one bedroom. It was the last public auction that took, not the last public auction that took place, but on the last weekend of auctions before the shutdown. And, she said and it actually sold for a really good price, this one bedroom kind of apartment in Pran. And she said she decided from sort of saying, okay, I'm going to go in and spend top dollar, that she just pulled out altogether because she was really fearful about what was going to happen. And she's sort of, you know, gone on the sidelines. But yeah, it's been mixed, definitely a mixed reaction from buyers. There is still competition in the market. It's not like the bottom's fallen out, but it's really patchy. Like there's I can go into the cheaper suburbs like Epping, you know, in the northern suburbs or the western suburbs, and find that there's competition even in regional areas. I was doing a negotiation on a property in Camperdown, and even there's two or three people that are hovering around the property. But there's there's in some properties are still getting enough buyer competition to get prices. But then there's other areas, that are just not selling at all. There's no buyers. There's no one inquiring about the properties that are already for sale. I think I heard from somebody who works for a very big selling franchise, who said that they got sales for the month had dropped by 65%. The busiest office had just, only made 9 sales or something for the month, where they were normally making a lot more. And so there's stories like that coming all over the place, particularly in the more wealthy suburbs. And then the thing that really sparked, I guess, fear for me is that obviously I'm dealing with buyers mostly. So buyer inquiry for me and all other advocates has kind of plummeted, obviously. It's not like, there's people that are still around and still hoping to buy. And, there's a few bargain hunters that kind of want to come in and see if they could see what they can get and see if there's any pickings around. But inquiry is really low. At the same time, when you're talking to the agents, what they're saying is that, I'm actually listing quite a few properties. And you're thinking, who is selling? Who's putting their properties on the market that doesn't have to at this point? And like I said, the transparency has gone so much that a lot of those properties are coming on. They're not being advertised. The agents bring them on as off-market sales to test. Just is very similar to 2018, very similar to the start of 2018. So they're testing to see if they can get market prices. And it feels like there is a lot of stock that is coming on, which could only be coming on if there was anticipation of, well, first of all, people that need to sell financially, so the government support isn't supporting them, or for some reason they can't access the mortgage holidays, whatever's going on there, or they anticipate that we really are entering the Great Depression and this is going to go on for an extended period of time. And we don't have the buyers. There's not enough buyers out there to soak up the stock that is coming on. And I mean, obviously we're going into other subjects now, kind of from the auction stuff, and I know you've probably got slides to show this, but it's really, it was the first thing, I think that was around the time that I wrote to you, Lee, and said, hang on, there's stuff going on the ground that just really starts to look like there's cracks showing in the market, and this isn't going to go well. But like I said, things, it's been such a changing atmosphere throughout, things changing very quickly. But that's in terms of the supply and the demand, there's some fear there of what's going on.
That's a perfect segue into the next slide, Tim.
Well done.
Which is basically what I've done here. I've put a chart from my buddy at CBA, Gareth Aird. He's the senior economist at CBA, and he's done this ripper chart last week, plotting housing sentiment, which is from the Westpac survey, against dwelling prices. And there's almost a very, very high correlation. And according to the Westpac survey, the housing sentiment, so that's the proportion of households expecting dwelling prices to rise over the next 12 months, has plunged to its lowest level on record since the question was first asked in late 2009. So again, this sort of feeds into this whole, plummeting sentiment. And it's really not that surprising, because obviously we've got this huge employment shock, and obviously, a lot of people have either lost their jobs or they're effectively on furlough and they're receiving welfare. And there's also been those who've managed to maintain their jobs, a lot of them have actually lost quite a lot of income. So living where I do in Melbourne's East, I've got, buddies at the parents at my daughter's school, et cetera, who've all had 20% pay cuts across the board, and they work for big four consultancies and that kind of thing. So it's pretty broad based. Tim, I might get you to swing over to the next chart, because it feeds into this as well.
Sure.
Where we talk about the actual rise in unemployment. Now, never as my time as an economist have I ever lived through a time when the official data is so out of step with what's actually going on. And that's because the labour market report from the ABS is only current to March, and it's only current to the first week of March, because that's when they do the monthly survey. So at the moment, the official unemployment rate's, pretty good. I think it's about 5.2% for March. But all the unofficial measures, so like Roy Morgan's survey, which they do a monthly unemployment survey, and they registered an absolutely massive jump in their unofficial unemployment measure from about 9%, which is always higher than the ABS because they measure it differently, 9% in March to about 17%. From early March, it was about 9%, and from late March, it jumped up to about 17%. So they had a huge rise, and that sort of correlates when we saw those huge crowds outside Centrelink and et cetera. And the Grattan Institute's done their own employment forecasts, released it earlier this week, and they're predicting Australian unemployment is going to hit between 10 and 15%. And that's actually understated, because the way the federal government's JobKeeper and allowance is, if you're on JobKeeper but you're not working, you're not actually counted as unemployed. So the actual, according to Grattan and a whole bunch of other research outfits, they're predicting the biggest unemployment shock since the Great Depression in the 1930s. So the biggest loss of jobs, and obviously that then leads into loss of incomes, etc. So that also helps to explain obviously why sentiment has collapsed for housing, not just housing, the economy. And to me, this is, and I'm sure Catherine probably agrees, unemployment sort of where the rubber hits the road in this thing, and how big the housing bust will depend on, among other things, but how high unemployment gets and how long this lockdown and the downturn persists. If the lockdown ends fairly quickly and we return to some kind of normalcy, obviously the economy will rebound quicker. But if it drags on, or if we get like a second wave virus outbreak or something like that, and then we end up obviously getting loads of small business failures, which then, person A can't pay person B can't pay person C. Well, that's going to lead to a much bigger economic downturn, and obviously will feed through the property market.
So Leith,
is that your sort of view, Catherine? Oh, sorry, David.
No, you go, Catherine.
That's, yeah, right. Absolutely. Oh, but Yeah, so I mean, we're certainly very we're quite bearish. I guess we're looking at this and just looking very much at the economic inputs and what we're seeing at the moment is we're looking at the stock market prices, and there's actually a relatively similar disconnect to what we saw in the first stages of the virus. So at the first stages, the virus was out there and the stock market just kept on rising and we're sort of looking at it going, just a minute, can't they see how bad this is going to be? And then we saw the stock markets took this big tumble and then have since recovered a fair chunk of that. But now we've actually started to see earnings get downgraded. And so the earnings falls have actually been further than what the stock market's fallen. So, and I'm not just talking about one-off returns. I'm talking about the earnings when you look out forward, like, you know, a year or two. And so, you know, from a valuation perspective, it's actually more expensive to buy the market today than what it was, you know, just before the market took a 30% tumble. And so
the price earnings ratio based on the forward PE is more expensive today, despite the fact the market's come off, say, 20% than it was, say, in mid-February when it was at its peak.
Right. Earnings have fallen further. So it still feels as if we're waiting for the other shoe to drop and for people to work out what's happening. I guess most of the issue though comes down to whether there's quite a firm held belief by a lot of people that there's a V-shaped recovery, and that the governments have done so much and it's all going to come roaring back. And some are even saying that the governments have done too much and they have to start winding it back already, which we think is crazy. We think that it's largely what we've seen so far is not stimulus. What we've seen is support. We're basically trying to cushion the blow. Mm. But there's still a blow. The blow is still happening. And people aren't going to turn around from being unemployed and suddenly rush out there and want to spend a lot of money. And there's a lot of people who, as you said, have just big consultancies that have just said, that's it, everyone's taking a 20% pay cut and we're letting go of 10, 15% of the workforce. And I think what companies generally find in these situations is if you let go of a decent chunk of your workforce is that your productivity increases. So you might say, let's say you've let go of 20% of your workforce, you can actually still operate at 90 or 95% of capacity. You've usually got rid of the part of the workforce that was quite low, wasn't that productive. And so when the recovery happens, they don't rush out and hire that 20% straight back. It takes a while and we've got all this excess capacity. And so, so for us, the unemployment side is critical. And that's where we just really haven't seen the falls yet. And until we do start seeing some economic impact, and as you know, we're only, 2 months into it. Takes, you know, for somebody to go broke takes 90 days just from when you stop paying your bills. And so we think you're still the effects to say, oh yeah, we're through it, it's going to be a V-shaped recovery as soon as we start opening up, we think is wildly optimistic.
There's also the psychological impact. I mean, you know, we often hear that Australia hasn't had a recession since 1991. Well, that has meant that there's a huge proportion of the working population that's never experienced a recession, and this was never even on the radar. But now that they've experienced this downturn, it's, you know, it must shatter confidence going forward and make people a lot more wary about going out and, you know, binging on debt, et cetera, going forward. So I think that could also be a structural change for the consumer to you know, the propensity to leverage up and not just into property, but, you know, expenditure more generally.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And you know, as you wrote, you've written extensively, you know, the Australian economy is very much built on the fact that we've been lending, we've been increasing our debt at a far greater rate than what we've been increasing our incomes. And so you're effectively saying we're relying on economic growth, the fact that people are willing to go out and borrow more than what they make, and consistently more than what they make over, you know, over the last 20 something years. Now we're the second most indebted households in the world. Are we going to come out of this and everyone wants to go out and gear up again? I mean, we saw when the Royal Commission came out and people had to wind back the lending, we saw big tumbles in house prices just from that. So, and that was like that wasn't that people didn't want to keep lending. That was just a regulatory thing where banks started to pull back. And so that actually that probably leads me into a question for you, Catherine. I was quite interested about your comment about banks pulling back on the lending criteria and people's approvals expiring. because that's another typically what you see in most crises is that the banks are freely lending at the start, and then the crisis happens, and banks then tighten up all their lending procedures, which then actually makes it sort of pro-cyclical, and it makes it worse. On the way up, they're loosening all their lending criteria as prices are shooting up, which makes prices shoot up even further. And then when prices roll over and then they start tightening, it actually then pushes it further down the other side because the credit's not there. Is that what you're seeing?
I think what we normally see when we're coming up to a crisis like this is you know, some kind of mortgage fraud going on, just as we did into the subprime crisis and the savings and loans crisis. And so you get rampant bank lending and low doc, no deposit loans, and you know, that kind of thing. The banks are, I think, what. So when the black swan kind of comes out the blue and pops the bubble, then the banks are in a really bad position. I mean, that's not to say that they're in a good position now, but it's a little bit of a different situation where we'd had 2008 and obviously all the cautionary stuff that came in from that, and then the banks running into the Royal Commission, and then they cut back on lending significantly over that point. And then we got out of that, and those conditions of the lending, the cautionary lending, even though the interest rates were coming down and they were starting to take the foot off the lever, because I think that we all know, and anybody who listens to this podcast will know, that the economy is choreographed around housing. And so there's a awareness that you can't really let prices drop and that you have to keep lending into the economy and keep encouraging people to go out there and buy properties, so that all the other industries that are...
Can we call it, rather than awareness, can we call it a belief by a number of people in power as opposed to an iron law of economics? But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the tax system kind of has encouraged that. And if you in Australia get to the point where you retire from your own home, then you're in trouble. I mean, the idea is that your home, therefore, is your retirement pot. And of course, what we're seeing now is a lot of people are accessing their super. And then, once they realize that they haven't got money coming in, are going to want to sell the home. And I'm not quite sure how that's going to go on the other side of this. But the banks can perhaps help for so long, but not for an extended period of time. And, you know, in the answer of when we would get out of this would be when the banks start to lend again, because at the moment, you know, there's no appetite in the banks to lend to people. Well, I mean, not only that, but the mortgage brokers have no work. I've been begged by mortgage brokers that I previously worked with have all reached out to me over the last few days asking, you know, do I have any clients? Is there anybody looking to buy? Because they've gone from being extremely busy, because that turn after the election was very unexpected and very strong. There was a big appetite out there for a bigger, you know, demand that kind of came into the system from home buyers principally. But the other thing that's happening as well is that people that had already purchased have either lost their jobs and are no longer able to settle, or they do not want to settle. And so the other thing that's been happening is a lot of agents getting back on the phone and saying, well, look, you know, the buyer doesn't want to settle. He wants to pass the contract on to someone else. So he doesn't want to lose his deposit. He wants to get someone else to take over the contract. And do you have anybody that can take over the contract? So there's been quite a few stories of that coming through as well. So, I mean, it's a situation where it's the banks aren't in as big a mess as they perhaps were when we were leading into 2008, but that doesn't mean that they're in a position to weather us through a long period of time. And it really does all depend on the length of the lockdown.
And I also add that that the AFR had a really good report earlier in the week about how the banks are basically the banks who'd given pre-approval to buyers, and even buyers that have gone out and bought the property, we're starting to actually reassess those loans to see if the people still had the same jobs and same income, and it actually cancelled those approvals. So there's also the risk that, you know, someone goes out with pre-approval, has bought a property, has comes around to settle it now, and suddenly the banks pull finance, so they can't settle, and they're basically left losing their deposit. We're starting to see those sorts of reports in the media, and also I've actually had some pretty extensive dealings with a mortgage broker recently, a really good guy. And he was super busy a few months ago. And I spoke to him last week, and he basically said he's got zero work, zero, not one person in the forward pipeline. And that is the whole, you know, the whole business has collapsed. So, you know, obviously that's just one mortgage broker, but that sort of corroborates what Catherine's just said.
So that's the thing, because that's exactly what I'm seeing, that the buyers that are already in the market and the homes that are already being, you know, the homes that are turning over, that's it. Once those buyers that are already in the market go, there's nobody coming up after them, and yet people are still selling, but there's still a fair degree of listings that are coming onto the market, and that doesn't even get into what's happening into the rental market. I mean, I've got numerous clients. I've got one that owns a property fund in Queensland that's a high exposure to commercial properties and three portfolios. And then I've got, other people that are that run a highly dependent on and run short-term holiday lets, and all of those properties, obviously, as we've heard in the press numerous times, being converted to long-term rentals, can't get tenants. So, I mean, it's a real, you know, it's a problem from that perspective as well as to what would happen. And then construction completely, you know, I mean, if you can't get a loan as a home buyer, then the construction projects that were under and can no longer sell, get the pre-sales, so the bigger ones. Now, I mean, that's numerous calls about big construction companies in problems. I've done quite a few that. And the small developers that are in the middle of doing projects that can now no longer access finance that they need, prospect of actually going broke because the projects that they're building have a buyer at the other end. They're not going to be able to sell it or rent it. I mean, that's the situation is really dire. When
there's about three or four things you've opened there that I want to bring back to. Let's start with the apartments, because before we move too far away from the house prices. So because I think last time we had you on, you were saying that while everything was running very hot in the housing market, it was still relatively flat in the apartment market at the time. So have you got any color on I'm assuming that everything you're seeing in the housing market is just that times two in the apartment market. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't. The only client that I've had that has been an apartment buyer was the one right at the beginning of this who was buying, you know, it was a classic. There's markets in Melbourne, and I'm sure this is the case in Sydney, probably more so in Sydney because it's more densified, and maybe the other areas to a lesser extent where they go very well, and even the apartments go well, where people really want to live. So Armdale, Paran, Elwood, Elstonwick, for example, if you're Melbourne based. So the apartment she was looking at had a lot of competition around it. But yeah, in the apartment blocks, I mean, there is no demand at the moment in the market at all. And I think that there's more because most people that live in apartments are renters. And most apartments are owned by investors. I think it's around 7 out of 10 apartments that you would find are owned by an investor. Then that's the side of the apartment market that's really getting hit. It's interesting you bring up the conversation we had last time, because I remember we talked about the coronavirus. This would have been in February.
It was, second week of February, I think, from memory.
Saying to me, what about, do you think the coronavirus might do it? And I was saying, I can't see it. I even joked after I had...
Don't worry about that. Nobody thought it'd be this bad. I mean, hardly anybody thought it'd be this bad. So,
just crazy. But
some of us have sold all our stocks on the back of that.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yes. So,
there were some bears out there.
Of course. But you know, what I mean, like, yeah, it's pretty. Yeah, you can't sort of, you know. Yeah, we scold yourself too much for not seeing that.
No, we were looking at it very much at the time anyway, as a big hit to demand and a big hit to supply from a number of different factors, with a tail risk of a pandemic. We weren't doing it because we were like, yes, the entire world's going into a pandemic. It was we could see where the shocks are coming to an already fragile economy, and there's the tail risk of a pandemic. And so that was sort of and now we're obviously in the power risk.
Catherine, just on the apartment thing, obviously, you know, there's no demand, et cetera. I imagine that's getting a lot worse now that we've got this, you know, flood of long-term supplies from Airbnbs, because those are typically, you know, concentrated in apartments. And I'll give you an example. Luckily, my dad sold out, I reckon, right at the peak. He was living in Freshwater Place in Melbourne. He actually had Grant Hackett's old apartment, would you believe? You know, the one he trashed. Anyway, he sold out of that one, and I reckon he's probably counting his lucky stars, because one of the reasons why he sold out of it was because the whole building got basically turned into Airbnbs, and he got sick of having parties there every weekend. It drove him nuts. And I can see a situation now where, with all the travel restrictions, that basically, you know, those 30% or 40% of apartments that became Airbnbs will now come in the long-term rental market and will flood supply and obviously depress the market more. Is that sort of your view?
Yeah, I wrote an article on it. Actually, it was a few years ago now, but even when I wrote that article, there was a website that one of our employees at Proper put me on to do the article, and it was showing you the rapid rise of Airbnb, more so in Sydney, you know, and up north in the holiday areas than Melbourne. But Sydney and Melbourne have the most Airbnb places. And I mean, I live in a high-rise apartment block. I rent in a high-rise apartment block, and we were talking about it yesterday with Leith. There's a lot of apartments in this block that will run as Airbnbs as well, because it's a fancy block, and so, you know, a lot of them will run as a holiday apartment. All of those, there is no one. There's no demand for Airbnb at the moment. I mean, nobody is traveling, and there's, I think that's the thing is the press, it's you were talking earlier about, you know, Australians. I think it was 60% of Australians weren't old enough to work when the last, you know, when the 1990s recession came in. And so they really don't know what it's like to have jobs vanish. You know, if you come from Europe and everything, you've lived through it. But, you know, to have jobs vanish around you and just to lose all your income. And I think the panic is palpable, and certainly through the press. And you get caught up watching the press, and it feels like it's going to go on forever. I mean, the initial thing at the beginning of this was in terms of the lockdown, talking about this being for 6 months. Now, if you're dependent on Airbnbs, and I know quite a few people that gave up their jobs to buy and to run Airbnb properties, who then were then saying to me, well, we're going to go under. We're very close to going under because we've got nothing, and I'll convert it into a long-term rental. And we don't have, there were no stats on that. So the government weren't keeping the stats on how many people had Airbnb properties. And some countries were doing better at that than we are. But I don't think we had anything that was showing that number. So like I said, the transparency in the real estate market it has gone. We don't have the auction market anymore to see where prices are going to go. We don't have an online listings market because the properties are coming on off market. No vendor's going to pay for advertising if they don't feel that they're going to be able to get a price.
And I suppose this also feeds into, you know, we know Australia's got an army of negatively geared landlords, right? So they're effectively, a lot of them are losing money in the hope of getting capital growth. They're effectively paying themselves they're basically making a loss so they can pay themselves they're doing a negative carry trade, I guess is what you want to call it. And and obviously with, you know, rental demand's going to collapse, or demand won't necessarily collapse, but rental supply is going to surge, rents will probably fall. A lot of them will be losing their jobs anyway. Can you see a situation where basically landlords are forced to sell, and because they're making these losses that they can no longer sustain?
That was, again, it's a very difficult thing to analyse as to whether that's going to be the case or not. And I think a lot of it depends on the length of the lockdown. But I think what happened at the beginning, remember when you sell a property, there's a serious, unlike the stock market, there's a lead into it. So you start to make plans and you start to plan it out. It's not something that you do instantly. And then you have a price in mind and a reason in mind and so on and so forth. So it could be a lot of the stock that we're seeing coming on at the moment is people that had those plans to sell and needed to sell financially anyway as we moved into this. Because, you know, we can look at the pandemic and say, okay, the pandemic's come and that's what's caused the current crisis. But we know, we're wise enough to know that that's not the case. The reason that we ever end up in an economic situation like this is because of how the economy is structured, the fragility of the economy when we come into it. And the economy wasn't doing that well. As you know. So, you know, coming into this where you've already got people that are highly leveraged, you've already got house prices that are, you know, 7 to 10 times income. And you've already got people that are in situations where they do have to sell because we didn't have a great time in 2018. I mean, anybody, you know, really because the housing market was going down and there was a lack of demand and construction was tanking. And so we came into this with a fragile financial system anyway. So there's people already now that need to sell and that needed to sell coming into this. And they're probably the people that have put their properties on the market and thought, well, we'll rush them onto the market because we don't know what's going to go on. And the news and the media is so dire. I mean, that there's no certainty. Business has no certainty as to when we're going to come out of this. And there's no confidence being put in, only that we all have to do this to protect the health service and, you know, so on and so forth. So, I mean, I think that we're going to see the true extent as to how, when people are going to hit that point of being in trouble in maybe a couple of months' time, to see how much stock's coming onto the market, whether we can actually see that as well, how much stock's coming onto the market, because as I said, that kind of transparency has gone. But the banks, I mean, the mortgage holidays, you know, I've been told that they've been offered up to 6 months. I've also had patchy stories from some people that have been able to access help and some people that haven't. I know people that have not been given overdrafts that they've needed, not been given credit that they've needed. I know of tenants that have refused to pay rent. the property managers, I mean, I think that they're, you know, there has to be some understanding here. You know, there was a lot of negativity that came in the press about property managers, but property managers are certainly being asked to, with very little legislation, to navigate this between a tenant and a landlord, a tenant that says that they can't pay rent and a landlord that says, I need my rent or I'm going to have to sell or I'm going to be in money trouble myself. So everybody's feeling an awful lot of pressure. And I can only think that unless they give... It can only go on for so long. And we know as well that the property market is very dependent on population growth. That is one
yes.
of...
Perfect segue.
Just before we jump into that, we've got one more left on unemployment. And I just sort of quickly pose a question to you, Leith. So you were mentioning before the way Roy Morgan are attacking... I think we just had a broad crash. Oh, my screens went blank. Okay, looks like we're back on. Apologies for that. We had a small break in the streaming process there. But yeah, so go ahead, mate.
So I assume you're talking about the official unemployment rate from the ABS.
That's right.
Look. Obviously, it's how long is a piece of string? I've got no idea what the official unemployment figure is going to come in at. Australian Treasury's got about, you know, penciled in 10%. Grattan's 10 to 15. Any of those things sound about right. The reason why it's so obscure at the moment is because the JobKeeper allowance. Basically, if you're on JobKeeper and you're not working, you're not going to get counted as unemployed, which is kind of ridiculous. But because of that, like we don't know how many people are going to apply for JobKeeper, and we don't know, therefore, what that's going to do to the official unemployment measure. What I will say, though, is that, you know, if we end up with, 10% unemployment, well, that's going to be slightly better than the early 90s recession, where I think it got up to nearly 12, and the early 80s recession, it got to, I think, about 11. But once you factor in the fact that underemployment is so much higher today than it was then, as well as we're going to have a whole bunch of hidden unemployment because of the JobKeeper allowance, this is almost certain to be the worst labour market since the 1930s Great Depression. But in terms of what that means for the actual headline unemployment rate that the ABS will report, I've got no idea. And that's my honest answer. Just because it's so obscured.
And part of it is does it really matter whether it's 16% or 15% or 14%? Look, certainly for the people, you know, for the people there. But in terms of an economic outlook, it's going to be really bad. But you just don't know. Coming up with a nuance between saying, oh, well, it was only 14% unemployment rather than 18% is probably not really not really much you can add from that. And you certainly wouldn't be buying stock markets at full prices or even property at prices that are pretty full in that type of scenario. If you thought
it all seems pretty net negative, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's basically semantics and splitting hairs, and especially when it's going to be obscured anyway by the, if you're on JobKeeper, you're no longer unemployed, even if you're sitting at home watching Netflix or playing Xbox. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I think it's important to keep harping back to that point, though, is that regardless of how fast you come out of this, like if you had a cure tomorrow and you're right, everyone's free to go and start doing things again, there's still a large number of people who have been unemployed, and there's going to be an effect of those people, how long it takes for them to get back into the workforce. And past studies basically show that, look, if you're over 50 or over 55 and a lot of people will never get back into the same level as what they did if they've lost their jobs at those levels. So, there are serious long-term structural issues that have already happened and have already passed, and there's already people who have far too much debt. And there's been a bunch of people who had as much debt as they could handle, and now they've realized that their salaries have just been cut or whatever it is, and now they're like, well, my impression of how much debt I can handle is now much lower than what it was 3 months ago. And so those impacts for us means you're looking at even if you did have a cure tomorrow, you're not coming to come roaring out of this as a V-shaped recovery and everything's all back to just the way it was.
And obviously, just to add on to Damien's point, obviously the longer this carries on as well, the worse it's going to be, because you're going to get more company collapses, et cetera, which will take longer then to recover. So, as Damien said, even if we come out of it quickly, it's going to hurt, and it's going to hurt more if the longer this drags on and the more business failures and etc. you get. So either way, it's not a great picture.
Sure thing. All right, well, let's roll across to immigration.
Yeah, so this is the final hammer in the coffin, I guess, if you want to put it
nail in the coffin.
sorry, nail in the coffin. Yeah, you can see I've been at home for too long by myself. So basically, as we know, Australia's had rampaging immigration for about 15 years. So it's been at very, very high levels. The inflows have been driven by temporary migration. So, for example, there's a chart for anybody here watching the live stream. In 2011, Australia had about 1.6 million temporary migrants. As at the end of last year, that was 2.4 million. So it's a massive increase. And that's been driving a lot of the population increase. Now, I'll add that the permanent migration program actually sets it in the long term, because if you're temporary, you eventually go home, and if you can transition to being a permanent migrant, you stay. Nevertheless, the projection is that the temporary migrants, that there'll be a reduction of about 600,000 temporary migrants this year.
Has that already happened, or that's a forecast?
No, it's a forecast for the 2020 calendar year. So as of the end of 2019, there was 2.4 million temporary migrants in Australia. The forecast was published in The Australian. I think it was Department of Home Affairs, or it might have been Abel Rizvi or someone. They've actually forecast that temporary migrants resident in Australia is going to fall from 2.4 million to 1.8 million. So that's a 600,000 reduction in temporary migrants. Which could send Australia's population growth negative, for the first time for generations. Now, obviously, less people in the country means less demand for housing, means less rental demand, etc. So it's just another one of these factors that will hurt the property market. And also, I think there's a good chance that immigration won't recover to its former heights for a long, long time, because A, the economy is going to be incredibly weak. And the last thing you want to do when you've got mass unemployment is have more foreign labour competing against locals. Second, there's a good chance that the international border at least is going to remain shut or have some kind of restrictions around it for a long time, which will stop, obviously, overseas, visitors. And I think, as the unemployment picture worsens, I think the people's tolerance for these sort of very, very high migration numbers we've experienced for the last 15 years will be pretty thin. I think it's going to be fairly unpopular politically. So It's just another one of these negative impacts for the Australian housing market, given especially Sydney and Melbourne, which have been the epicentres. Sydney and Melbourne have taken about 75% of Australia's migrants, or sorry, New South Wales and Victoria, and that's Sydney and Melbourne mostly, over recent years. So they'll by rights be the hardest hit. They've also been the two cities that have obviously experienced the biggest housing bubbles on the back of this and other factors. So I think this will be another just another hammer blow.
And the thing to think about as well is coming back to the number of renters. So if you sort of said it's about a third of Australia that rents, I think, ballpark, maybe a little bit less. So if you go, okay, so that's, call it, you know, 9 million people or something like that that are renters out there. If you all of a sudden get rid of, you know, 15% of them to a little bit less than that. Yeah, close to 10%, I suppose, once you account for that, plus all the people who are then shuffling up and just more people living per house and sharing rooms or sharing renting out extra bedrooms and stuff like that, then you could easily see, 10% of the Australian housing's rental demand go overnight or pretty much within a month or two.
Catherine.
Well, I was going to say the other aspects that kind of come into it also in the commercial property market, we should probably talk about what's going on there as well.
Yeah, actually, sorry, can we finish up on the residential first? But I definitely want to come back to that and developers as well. Sure. I still have my list. But I'm just interested, I guess what I'm trying to get to with this rental market is I'm interested in knowing how much can rents fall, I suppose. Leith, do you have any gauge on sort of historical?
Yeah, I do. I mean, the classic examples, it seems fairly pertinent, is Perth. So the Perth, obviously Perth had this massive run up in migration and it was going really strong before the commodity bust. And then, you know, population growth never turned negative there. It just, it went from running at about 4% down to about 0.7 at the same time as construction was starting to catch up. So Perth actually experienced about a 20% fall in rents, nominal rents, not even real, over about 5 years. So that was a 20% haircut in rents, in rental rates, according to the ABS. So if you applied the Perth scenario to Sydney and Melbourne, well, that's 20%. But
that'd be your base case. That'd be your bullish case, like the most positive. You know, if you're saying because unemployment rose by 2%, maybe.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I think it got to about 6.5% max unemployment in Perth. So yeah, it could be a lot worse than that.
Yeah,
but I think
that's probably the best example I've got for a decent. If you want to look at these mining places, for example, where tiny populations and it's more volatile, obviously. But for a decently populated place in Australia, that's the most recent example I can think of.
I think that was also stats that were coming from the mining towns, though, wasn't it? Places that were, being rented for $1,000 a week, falling to.
I know Perth's just metropolitan Perth. So if you went to Mandurah or some of the other mining strongholds like Gladstone, Caratha, whatever, it's obviously a lot worse than that.
Yeah,
yeah. All those places are a lot worse, but actual metropolitan Perth fell about 20%.
I think, to see how far rents are going to have to fall, I think we have to wait a little bit too to sort of see what the impact of that is going to be. Again, the housing market, so it's sticky in prices, sticky in rents, because you've got individual vendors sitting behind those properties in different financial positions that are always reluctant to reduce prices initially. And so it takes a while sort of see that impact come down, and we would have to know what's going to happen with this pandemic, and again, how long the lockdown's going to go on for. I think that's mostly the nerves and the uncertainty at the moment, and I think that we saw that a lot of that happening in 2018 in terms of the buying market, people not knowing whether prices were going to continue to drop and kind of waiting on the sidelines. And I think that there's a lot of that going on at the moment in the housing market, as to watching what's from something that was, how quickly we're going to come out of this, and is there going to be any relaxation in terms of travel, but even just between states, But I mean, it's, you know, potentially we're looking at a big oversupply property. And I think with the commercial, with the shops that have been left vacant, I mean, we had a lot of that going on as well before we came into this. There were a lot of shop vacancies. There were a lot of vacancies at the bottom of apartment buildings. And then not to mention that the study that we do at Prosper every year, you know, looking at actually how many people are occupying properties based on water usage. And even if we just go from the zero, you know, residential properties that were using 0 litres of water for a 12-month period, I mean, there were, you know, tens of thousands of them. So, you know, those types of things, and the idea that commercial, you know, the we've just got so it's gone from it just all happened so suddenly and so quickly to see that kind of impact and how it's going to play out. You have to look at the prospect that we are on the verge of what could be a housing crash, and we haven't that could be worse than 1991. And if that happens, it would pull the economy. It would put the economy in a much worse position and take a lot longer to get out of this.
Sorry, Catherine. Can I just quickly add something? I was just going to say that people often look at they look at population growth and look at dwelling construction. They sort of, you know, match the two up and they go, okay, here's your underlying, you know, supply shortfall. Here's the surplus, whatever. But the other thing that's rarely taken into consideration is that when you have a sharp economic downturn, demand can actually change. Like, I'm talking about not just credit demand, I'm talking about actual fundamental demand. Because, and we saw this in places like the US, etc. When there's an economic downturn, you're more likely to get people, you know, kids move back home, you get more share houses, that kind of thing. So you can actually see, you know, Australia's got about 26 million people sharing about 10 million dwellings. You can actually see that you don't need as many dwellings because you get more people sharing properties, and then that can hammer demand and make the oversupply worse. So I think we're also going to see that as well, not just weighing on the rental market, but also weighing on the need to build more homes and weighing on the oversupply.
Yeah. And as you said, it's the difference between going from 2.6 to 2.8 is all of a sudden an almost 10% change in the number there in terms of the demand. So
it doesn't have to change much.
On top of all these temporary visas and students who aren't coming, and yeah, yes,
pretty nasty.
On the commercial side as well, Catherine, I don't know how much you've seen from your end, but it seems to me that there's certainly a lot of companies that are now everyone's having to work from home and are basically working it out, and it's get to the stage where they go, well, you know what, we didn't think we could have people working from home, but actually that worked. You know, we eventually got it working. And, you know, maybe we'll let people work a day a week from home now, or we'll let them work, you know, 2 days a week from home. And all of a sudden our demand is 20% lower or 40% lower for how much commercial property space, how much commercial office property space is needed.
That was happening before anyway. So I think that was happening. I mean, I've been through that with a few companies and seen that process where people have been, you know, big overheads have been taken out, and then the office ends up half empty because people have been, you know, again, it's a prospect of how the housing cycle works. You know, people move further away to access a more affordable land, and then the commute into work becomes too long, and there's and now we can work from home. So, I mean, that was happening, and I think that that's certainly going to continue. I mean, I have wondered. I, for one, am quite desperate to get to be let out of my apartment and get. I mean, I think that kind of trend was happening. It's interesting if you look back at pandemics historically. You know, there's always a lot of technological change on the other side and economic changes that come on the other side of it, and it's been. I think that you know, even though what we're going through now is very bad, there has been little bits of positive news that's kind of filtered out that gives you an idea of how things are going to change. And obviously technology and everybody being, you know, finding different ways to communicate and familiarising themselves with that and feeling a lot more familiar with it are going to continue to work from home. Maybe going to push regional areas more, but also looking at the policy responses. I mean, I think... you know, there's now suddenly this great fear that we've somehow got to pay back this government debt. And Daniel Andrews came out a few days ago saying, oh, you know, we're going to have a look at hope I'm paraphrasing this okay, stamp duty to land tax. Another
oh,
premier
really?
Did.
Yep.
Yeah, I got sent, they kind of flew under the radar. I got sent to
I missed it. I need to put that up on MB.
I know. I'll send you the article. Someone sent it to me on Messenger. Said, "Have you seen this? You know, this is what you're talking about." So there's and then I think there was someone else who came out and said, "You know, you've got to go back and have a look at the Henry tax review," because I think they're realizing. I think there's this. The trouble is the narrative has to change, obviously, around government debt. You know, and for the first time, I think governments are realizing that you know, deficits can actually be stabilizing to an economy. They're not necessarily destabilizing, which is what we've been told for years and years, is that it's better for us to be in surplus than it is in deficit. And that narrative has now kind of changed, obviously, coming into this. But there's been quite a bit of talk about doing tax reform. And I think that if there's ever a time to do it, it's always these points, because people do get very humbled where their wealth gets taken away and they become, you know, it becomes that kind of atmosphere where you can make those changes and meet little resistance around them. I've looked at all sorts of things that could happen. But I think the interesting thing is travel. When those borders are going to be open and when people are going to move around safely again and not feel that fear. And I think whatever's going to happen, we've got a prospect that this is going to be it for the year. You know, certain things aren't going to change dramatically the economy. It's not going to dramatically
And I'd be saying travel's pretty much the last thing to come back. Mm. So,
everything else. Especially international travel.
Yeah.
Yes.
Actually, just on that one, we've just got a couple of questions that have come through on, somewhat in the same vein. So we haven't spoken about international demand for Australian housing yet. Do we have any perspective on how the crisis is affecting Chinese buyers, or international buyers, perhaps probably more Indian on the western side of Melbourne and Chinese on the eastern side? But so if China imposes even stricter financial controls in the coming years, is that going to have a further downside effect on blue chip properties in the east of Melbourne, typically?
We're not seeing any buying at the moment going on. So, I mean, now it's not so much a problem. But I think a lot of the foreign buying that was happening over here were from people that were establishing connections over here. So kids coming over to study. So a lot of Chinese international students studying and then buying with family money. That was very common. I had quite a few contacts that were kind of doing that kind of thing. So, I mean, at the moment, you know, obviously with the dollar weaker, you know, it makes Australian property look very, in a sense. But I know that there were some stops put on that, Leif.
Every single, I think, foreign investment proposal now is going to be scrutinised by FIRB. But not just that. I mean, obviously the international student trade's been smashed. So we're going to see a massive reduction in international student numbers here, which should not just impact obviously the rental market, but also that sort of flow on, you know, purchases of established dwellings that Catherine was alluding to. So, I think that whole foreign buyer bid's going to be absolutely hammered for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's another side to this. I think that it would be foolish to think that things aren't going to, you know, I mean, things aren't going to change when we get to the other side. And I mean, you know, if you look back at pandemics, people, you know, look back at the Spanish flu. I mean, more people died in the Spanish flu than in World War I and World War II combined. I remember reading an article about it last year without even thinking about it. But they were saying, why don't we remember? Why don't we remember the Spanish flu and what happened after that? And there was this whole consensus that people just wanted to forget. They wanted to forget. They wanted to get out. And there was, some quite interesting books that were written around that time. One was called something along the lines. I've been trying to get hold of it. You know, real estate agents celebrate on the other side of there was the same number of shutdowns and everything. So I think you kind of see that after war, after periods of time where people's movements have been constrained and life has changed quite significantly, of this desire to forget. So I think there is another side to this, but certainly I think, you know, sort of throughout this year and into next year, there's going to be significant effects
And I think you're absolutely right, Catherine, but and people will forget and you'll move on. But one of the things I do think with the differences between the 1918 and now is, as you said, they were literally just rolling out of a world war. And so things were, even though there was this big pandemic going on and people were dying, at least people weren't all shooting each other. And so there was sort of like and then they finally, so I guess what I'm saying is people were already depressed about things and had come from a very bad place. And then ended up in another bad place in a pandemic, and then eventually came out of it. And so, and off they went. Whereas now we've come from, I think there's the shock of is going to be greater for people who are like, everything's happy. I'm running my debt as much as I possibly can. Everything's, you know, we keep pumping more and more money into this economy and keep lowering interest rates. And then to be
recession
suddenly
for 30 years as well. Yeah. No recession for 30 years.
Exactly, and then to be suddenly hit with this and having to go into that, I think there will be a bigger effect than if you'd already had your big negative downturn of being in a world war, and then you sort of, you know, I guess it's the sudden shock of it. But there was an interesting comment though as well. One of the questions about that from a viewer about you know, how can banks do it? Is it 50 or 100 year mortgages? And so. I mean, it's an interesting way about saying, you know, if we want to keep living the way we're living in terms of trying to get people to borrow more, and hoping that that'll, you know, if we can just get people to borrow more, then that'll fix everything. I mean, that was obviously the government's view that if we give new home buyers 95%, let them borrow up to 95%, then everything will be fine and the property market will go up. And so that'll be a sign in terms of those changes, as you said, Catherine. You know, we've been told that we need to change and we need to put in structural reform. But if we start seeing 50, 100-year mortgages pop up, and if we start seeing, you know, governments backstopping people to get 95% mortgages in order to get the housing market going again, I think that's a pretty clear sign that we haven't learned too many lessons and we're trying to get back onto that same treadmill.
I think that
Sorry, Catherine, you go on.
Well, I was going to say historically that's exactly what's happened after every crisis. You know, I mean, that there's a very eagerness to get, you know, what did Daniel Andrews say? The biggest construction boom ever is going to have to be even bigger than ever. You know, so there's a, I mean, if you look at the stimulus, the stuff that's going into the economy at the moment, it's enough. It's just enough to keep people paying the debt so that they can keep paying the banks, the debts, the mortgages, even the mortgage holidays. You know, it's going to end up advantaging the banks more because it's going to be more money on the loan at the end of it. So, I mean, you know, ultimately, we just have a history of that in Australia, that after the GFC, that the way to get the economy going is to throw in a few first home buyer grants and encourage people to kind of get out there spending again. So, you know,
It's going to be very hard, though. I mean, obviously, you know, mortgage rates are hitting their lower bound. They can't really come down any further than they are now. We've got, you know, with the cash rate the way it is, et cetera. So pretty much the only way you can juice it is by doing what Damien said, those kind of things where you increase the amount that people can borrow by, you know, 50-year mortgages, 100-year mortgages, allowing people to borrow up to 95%, you know, by massively loosening credit standards, that kind of thing, because you're not going to get it from the cost of debt side. It's all got to come from the, you know, from the availability side. So, you know, and it's just getting harder and harder. You're pushing on a string now because
this is a Ray Dalio version of the way the world works, because I think it's very accurate in terms of the, you know, if you look at debt cycles, you have these long-term debt cycles and you have the short-term debt cycles. And the shorter-term debt cycles is more like 10, 20 years where debt builds up to a point and then you have some sort of crisis or recession and debt falls away, but it never falls as far as it was prior, and then it builds up again to a higher level than what it reached and then falls away. And so you've got this amplitude of debt getting higher and higher every time until eventually you get this cleansing event where you actually do have big corporate deleveraging or great depressions or whatever it is, which it really pulls it right down to a really low level, and you have the mega crisis. And I think a lot of people thought that was what was going to happen in the 2007, and that you would have this cleansing and the whole debt, but it didn't. It sort of, you know, we managed to roll it back into a, maybe we can just shove more debt and we just switch it from being with the consumers across to the governments and the corporates. In other countries, in Australia, we kept it with the consumers as well. And so it is that question coming back for this one, is this a big cathartic event where you finally see things change, or is it a matter of saying, no, we're just going to try and convince people to borrow more money by however, as you said, 50, 100 new mortgages or a bunch of other ways. And then that means we're then biding time till the next crisis happens, and then we're really out of bullets. So I'm sort of slightly on the fence. I do think there's a greater than 50% chance that this is the one that will cause some structural change, but there's plenty of people who don't want that to happen. And so, yeah, I think those 50, 100 year mortgages and are probably one of your best indicators that are we going to just try and do the same thing all over again?
Just any final questions, I guess, for each other, just before we roll into the investment outlook? We'd be mindful of time.
And from me.
I've got lots, but I don't think I've got enough time to answer them all. actually, I might just ask really quickly, so just with a quick two-minute answer, the developers, Catherine, you alluded a little bit to developers and construction really struggling to get loans. Is that the case from what you're seeing?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they were struggling to get loans. They've been struggling to get loans since the Royal Commission. And even after the Royal Commission, the values really haven't come up high enough to, even then the banks were being cautious about giving developers loans. Interest rates hadn't really come down a lot for them. And the prices just hadn't come up enough of what was being developed, apartments, townhouses and everything, to really give much energy into the development sector. And then because this has hit, I mean, if we do swing back on the other side of this, obviously I'm just talking about what we're seeing from right now. But if we were to swing back on the other side of this, then we've had really very little constructed. Construction has really tanked. So, it's a real problem for developers. A lot have gone into administration. There was a record number that went into administration anyway in 2019. And a lot of big developers in trouble. That's not to say everything, there's still stories. The press, and we all sort of tend to look at the dark side and what's going on. But I mean, if you really dig around, there's still stories where you're seeing people that are moving in just as you did, after just as you do in every recession, really, that are moving in and kind of picking up sites and taking advantage of what's going on now to negotiate deals on commercial buildings in the city and commercial sites and so on and so forth. So there are companies that do have cash behind them. That are able to take advantage of what's happening now, but the vast majority were really caught out with the Royal Commission. The effect on the housing market over that period was quite unexpectedly severe, and so the real estate market has struggled. And I guess coming into that, that's a little bit of a blessing to an extent, because we didn't have as much speculation as there probably would have been had that not come in and slowed the market for that period of time. And then we were just playing, for want of a better term, catch up to get back to the 2017 levels anyway last year. And it really wasn't there. It wasn't a boom market last year. It was just a market that was short on supply and had a lot of home buyers that were trying to get in. But that didn't mean that there weren't, properties passing in and negotiations going on. And, that's the only thing that I can sort of say coming into this, is that if some happening that the events were to change for a vaccine or whatever else, and the borders were to open, and that we were to go back into population growth, and the Airbnbs turn back into Airbnbs, and we start back up on that again, because we haven't had a great degree of construction leading up to this, then we could potentially be facing then the reverse of it, rent increases and whatever else, sort of comes into it. So I guess we have to keep our minds open a little bit as to the unexpected. Things always catch you out. You're never quite sure how things are going to work out. But I think in terms of anybody thinking about, like I said, it's a sticky market with house prices. So things are happening very quickly, but prices are lower now than they were a week, 2 weeks ago. When this, whole thing really, 2-3 weeks ago, when the whole thing really started. So we're seeing discounting, and how far that discounting will go is something to watch pretty carefully.
Absolutely.
Okay. I think that's a great segue into getting Catherine on in about a month or so to give us another update.
Still in my apartment, locked.
Yeah. You never know. We might be back in the office by then. We'll see how it all goes. But look, yeah, thanks very much for your time today. A terrific, quite long one on a huge topic, obviously, and very front of mind, I think, for most Australians. Catherine, do you mind just sharing with our listenership, of course, how they can get in touch with you and follow some of your work?
Yeah, absolutely. You can go to cashmoreco.com.au, prosper.org.au, or you can go on, I write for Fattail Media, a publication called Cycles, Trends and Forecasts, where we talk about the property cycle, a little bit more information in that than we've shared today, but yeah.
Very good. Okay. Well, look, yeah, thanks again for coming along today. And we certainly look forward to getting you back on very soon to give us another update on this prolonged topic and very, very hot button topic as well. So thanks again, Catherine.
No worries at all.
And we'll jump across now to the investment outlook. Damien, if you want to just quickly run through, we've had unemployment as the number one issue.
Yeah, I think that's the key thing from all of this that you know, you've probably taken out is that we're quite negative on the whole situation, and certainly from an economic point of view, we're just saying we just haven't seen the economic effects come through yet in any of the statistics. As Leith was saying, all these backward looking stats, you're just not seeing it. The company earnings that we're seeing is still haven't fallen as far as we think they will fall, and so for us, working out you know, how big the economic downturn is going to be and how bad the unemployment is going to be pretty key in terms of working out how much forced selling are you going to see. And once you get those forced selling and the unemployment, that sort of passes you past that point of pretty much no return in terms of those don't come back quickly. So if people stay employed and just hunker down for a little bit and then they get to come back, you will be able to bounce back and see these V-shaped recoveries. We think it's already past the point where the unemployment rates have already spiked high enough that you're not going to see that come back rapidly. And you only need whatever it is, 5% extra people unemployed to all of a sudden they need to sell their houses or a chunk of them need to sell their houses or they need to move in somewhere else or you know, everyone downgrades and that domino effect of as it just chips along of all the different lower demand, it becomes self-reinforcing. So I think I might leave it at that for given how long we've gone today.
Yeah, sure. Just a quick one, actually. Just touching on bonds, if you wouldn't mind, Damien. I've got a question around it as well, but perhaps just share your thoughts on bonds. At the present, we obviously favour bonds quite heavily in the portfolio.
Yeah, certainly we have. We're lightening up. We're starting to lighten up on our positions. But having said that, the Australian bond market, like there's a lot of questions about saying, well, why do you buy bonds? Say a 10-year bond yield, you can only get a 0.8% yield at the moment. And so I guess it's more of a some of these we look upon them as more of an option. In terms of saying, if things get worse, then the value is actually going to go up, and then you sell them and buy shares at a cheaper price. And for other elements, you're pretty locked in. You're actually getting your running yield is sort of say 3%, and you're sort of losing a little bit of capital every year on these things. So, but net, you're actually not going to lose money on it if you're holding to maturity. So we look upon it as being the big issue for bonds is when we start seeing inflation come up, and we're not seeing any inflation at all. And as we spoke about with Leith just a minute ago, there's a pretty decent chance you'll get falls in rents of 10% plus, and probably 20% is probably a reasonable estimate of quite a positive outcome for houses, and that's going to weigh on inflation for years, and quite possibly we'll see deflation, and in deflationary point of view, again, bonds become a more attractive asset. So we think there's still some capital gains to be had in that. And we don't think there's actually that much risk. But I've got a post coming out. It'll be out before Saturday. So on just bonds and where we see some of the risks.
Yeah, okay, fantastic. And just sort of, and obviously we're talking about Australian federal government bonds in our portfolio, and this question just relates to diversified bonds. Just got out before the central banks in particular, the Fed backstopped all debt, including junk debt. And this is the US Federal Bank.
Yeah.
Given the backstopping, is it now okay to expose our monies to diversified bonds?
Yeah, this is a. I think I might leave most of this. This is a whole podcast topic in itself. But I guess the issue is there's two main types of bonds you can buy. Let me call it three. There's government bonds, which tend to, when you get periods of crisis, they tend to go up in value. There's corporate bonds, which tend to go down in value a little bit, and from a little bit to a lot. And then there's the high yield or the junk bond market that really goes down when it's effectively an equity exposure. So when the crisis happened, they really fall. The US government's come out and, or the central bank, sorry, come out and they're backstopping and they're actually out buying corporate bonds. They tend to be fallen angels, where these were bonds that used to be good quality, but are no longer. There are other bonds that are currently good quality, or they used to be good quality just before the crisis, and then that's fallen away. So you can jump out and try and buy the corporate bonds, I guess. The issue you have there is this moral hazard issue in terms of, will you get this stage where at some stage where you do start getting more realistic pricing in the market, and it's a question of how much you trust your central bank. If you have implicit faith in what central banks can do to that corporate bond market, then you might be able to jump out and front run the central banks. But certainly the real prices of these bonds are much lower. And we don't think at the moment central banks are going to be stepping in to bail out everyone, especially the small and medium businesses that aren't listed and don't have that debt out there, mm-hmm. because that's one of the real places where you're going to see lots of the problems in the debt market. So, so corporate bonds, if you really trust your central banks and you want to front run them, then do it. But know that you're buying a bond that's actually not worth in the general market what you're paying for it. It's just that you think you could sell it back to the central bank at a high price of what you bought.
Artificially supported.
So. Yeah.
Yep. Okay, very good. All right, well, thanks very much, gentlemen, for a terrific terrific podcast today and a wonderful topic. And thanks again to Catherine for coming along. Next week, we will be looking at the coronavirus investment update. So that's Thursday, the 30th of April. Plenty more information, I'm sure, to come out between now and then. And so we're going to be running back through the figures and how it's driving our decisions in the Nucleus Wealth portfolios. So head on over to nucleuswealth.com/webinar once again for a live show. And have your questions answered live. We'll see you there. Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return, we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.